Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When I was a kid, my dad was a cop. You see, my dad was a cop in the 1980s in Sydney, which has been widely regarded as one of the most dangerous times to be a police officer in Australia. It was basically the Wild West. So I wrote a book about it. It was called Loose Units. And then we did a podcast about it. Loose Units Season 1 was an incredible experience, and we loved every minute of it. But it turns out that Dad did more than just patrol the streets. He plunged headfirst into the terrifying world of forensics. So on this season of Loose Units, that's what we're doing. We're going deep into the world of forensics and fingerprints and all of that good stuff. Well, I say good stuff. Actually, things got worse than ever. So strap in for Loose Units Season 2, Electric Blue. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Season 2 of Loose Units, officially called Loose Units Season 2, Electric Blue. I can't adequately express just how excited I am to be back in the studio, and with me, as always, is my dad, John Verhoeven.
How do you do, Paul?
That sounds very weird, isn't it? Very formal, Jesus.
Hi to all the incredible listeners out there who've been incredibly, amazingly supportive.
Yeah, this show has really taken off.
The numbers are staggering.
So obviously this season is going to deal with forensics. Now, just to clue you all in a little bit, for those of you who don't know, Dad was a cop in the 80s in Sydney, and he was exposed to some really horrific stuff. And I wrote a book about it called Loose Units, and then Dad and I realised there's a whole bunch of cases that were too contentious and too weird to put in the book. So we did Loose Units, the podcast, and because of all of you listeners, the podcast kind of skyrocketed into something approaching just nuclear grade awesome. So season two is the forensics years. Now, it's going to be bigger than the last season. It's going to be, I would say, more intense than the last season. We won't be putting trigger warnings on every episode, but sometimes we will have to do that. I think we briefly touched on the forensic stuff last season. We just dipped in a little bit. In fact, you and I appeared on Michelle Laurie's Australian True Crime podcast, and you told a story from the forensics years. So technically speaking, people's first taste of Loose Units was the forensics years. So are you excited to be back in the studio?
I'm extremely excited. These are the actual... No. Why are you laughing?
Because Dad's a little sedate. From an audio perspective, your levels are a little lower than mine.
Yeah. Highly animated, but it's in the genes.
I would say so. Well, that would imply I got that from
your mother.
But she's not this loud.
Well, she's also got, I was going to say a beard, but no, she doesn't.
No, she doesn't at all.
Kidding.
No. And you can't grow beards.
No, I'm going to try and stay on track because, I mean, I do tend to go all over the shop.
Yeah, as do I. Now, for those of you who are listening to Loose Units for the first time, hello, welcome to this bizarre family that we've got right here. To those of you who are donating to the Loose Units Patreon, to those of you who follow us on Facebook and follow us on social media, to those of you who sent in questions, I hope you're as excited as we are for this season. This is the first episode, so we won't waste too much time. But a question that I've had a few times, Dad, is what exactly is forensics? Like, okay, so just imagine you're from another planet and you land and somebody explains to you just the outline of what a cop is. What is forensics?
Okay, well, let's imagine you landed in a flying saucer.
Yep.
And when you landed, you actually squashed some humans.
Sure.
So kind of we'd have a bit of a crime scene happening.
Sure.
You didn't expect that answer, did you?
Shit, no. You've gotten better at this.
Thank you. So, I mean, I think we should point out to the audience and to all the amazing people out there that this is 100% unrehearsed.
Yeah, we don't script anything.
Nothing. It's totally live. And Paul actually has no idea what I'm going
to
say.
Yeah, if you go back and listen to season one, there was this lovely moment during the episode called Smugglers, which is my personal favourite episode, where you told me a story about something that happened to you and Mum after the police force. And I was so floored, I had to go for a walk to process what you told me.
No, it was pretty amazing.
And we want to maintain that kind of... So a lot of the times, listeners, when you hear a story and you react very viscerally to it and you kind of like are reeling, I'm doing that too in the studio
but
with
Paul,
you.
Can we get back to the spaceship?
Don't.
In a nutshell,
yeah.
I won't do the visual nutshell.
Well, it wouldn't translate.
Correct. So imagine that the spaceship landed, killed a few people, and then pissed off. So the local police come in and see all these squashed people
on the road. Hang on. I appreciate the metaphor, but just so you know, in the metaphor, we're in the spaceship. So hang on. You can't explain how a crime scene works.
No, I am.
No, because we've already left.
No, we weren't in the spaceship.
No, you said imagine you're in a spaceship.
Oh, but I mean, you know, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, so hang on, are we sticking around? Maybe, okay.
Okay, but the point is that the local police would be confronted with a particular crime or a scene of death and destruction.
Yeah.
They would call in forensics, and forensics' job would be to try and piece together, for example, the tire prints on some of the... cadavers from the wheels on the little spaceship.
Okay, now you're implying that the spaceship has wheels.
Yep.
What, what are you thinking? A flat? No, this is a futuristic spaceship. It's meant to look metal feet.
Yeah. Paul, can we just stay on track? And then say some of the bodies were unidentifiable. So then forensics also would be involved in the identification of the bodies that visually you'd find it difficult to identify. Like, you know, if a member of the family of one of the deceased was looking down and said, I just can't recognise that particular person as my son or daughter.
Sure.
Then forensics again, when the body was conveyed or the remnants put into a bag and then taken to a morgue, then forensic work would start. And obviously when I was in forensics, we didn't have DNA.
Right.
Even though weirdly... the DNA, the evidence, because we kept a lot of the samples from crime scenes. They're still kept in warehouses.
Sure.
And that's why today, with DNA, they're starting to, you know, solve cold cases from years and years and years ago when we didn't have that. It was like you kind of knew that in the future there'd be this amazing technology that would enable one. Am I?
No, it makes sense. You know how Walt Disney had his head frozen? It's like
that. Yeah.
On the assumption that one day someone will have the tech to make it work.
Amazing, but that ain't going to happen with Walt.
I don't know.
No, not a chance.
So that's interesting, but...
And they use a lot of different services. They use fingerprints, DNA, you know, just sort of collecting minute evidence, putting together a whole lot of scientific information and then coming up with, if they can, sort of adding to the case and helping them solve it.
Right. But as far as I'm aware, forensics is very science-driven. Yeah, you have to have an innate understanding, a learned understanding of how the body works, how decomposition works. As a patrol officer, which you were, how the hell do you then segue into a way more scientific, granular field? Did you have to undergo training?
All on the job. But that's completely different today. Today, there are degrees in... what's that word I'm looking for?
I feel like
forensics.
I feel like you would have failed straight off.
Forensics, and it's all, I'm pretty well positive that in at least the New South Wales Police Force, all the scientific, you know, people that are involved in that section are all university trained, and they're not police officers. But in the day, it was on the job training. Where as a junior constable, I was very fortunate to have an opportunity to work at Chatswood. And it used to be called Scientific.
Right.
So it was Chatswood Scientific, and I managed to score a job as a young constable. My position there was called Relieve and Assist. That sounds weird.
Yeah.
But back then it meant to come in, and if someone was away, you'd sort of fill their role to keep the numbers up.
Fill their role in Scientific or just in any department?
No, in Scientific. There was a particular job called Relieve and Assist, Chatswood Scientific. And, you know, there were lots of people that applied, and I obviously impressed the people that were interviewing.
Yeah.
And I got the gig.
So talk me through this, because one of the great things about the patrol years and about the book was that I had a real sense of place about the academy and about North Sydney Police Station, which you can still go to. Could you describe this building that you were working
in? Okay, well, it was attached to Chatswood Police Station, which was in another division north of where I was at North Sydney.
Yeah. Was it weird changing stations? Did you get any... I mean, is there a certain kind of allegiance to where you started?
Well, it was weird because they were in a little cottage out the back of the station, like an actual freestanding cottage. But one of the great things about it, which was weird for me, is that it was plain clothes work. Oh. So that was my first foray into plain clothes. And when you're in plain clothes, or at least when I was in the job, you felt kind of special. You felt, I won't say superior, because that sounds as though, you know, I'm a wanker. Anyone in plain clothes in the New South Wales Police Force, and for that matter, probably any police force, at least in Australia, that you, I mean, it was, when you were in uniform, generally one aspired, or at least a lot of people I knew, aspired to get into plain clothes.
Right.
It was like a step up. And you had that anonymity, like you still carry a gun, but you got around in unmarked cars, and it was just
Oh, it's different. Miami Vice.
Yeah, well, it was great because, you know, you're driving along, you're still a police officer.
Yeah.
Like, you don't just sort of go, well, now I'm in forensics, I'm not actually a policeman. You've still got all the same powers. If you see something horrendous happen, you could, if you wanted to, you could either A, get involved, or B, perhaps look the other way.
Okay, I have a question for you. When you're a patrol officer and you're on duty and you're in the uniform and you finish a shift, you take the uniform off and you're not a cop anymore, having that thing there to delineate when you are and aren't a police officer is obviously fairly useful. And it's useful for the community because, you know, it's good to know where the police are.
Correct.
Was there ever a time where you were technically not on duty, but because you're an off-duty police officer, those lines blurred and you felt like you could actually still behave like a cop? Like, did those lines ever get a little bit fuzzy for you?
No, and I've been out of the police force for a long, long time.
Right.
But I still, like, I was up in... We live up in King's Cross, which is a fairly notorious red light, and there, I've got some great King's Cross forensic, particularly horrific stories that pertain to that area, which was a tough place back in the 80s.
Sure.
And a couple of weeks ago, there was this incident while we were having lunch, and it was pretty bad. And it was, and the police were called. And it's really weird. You always kind of this mechanism, internal mechanism inside you, just switches on, and you kind of revert back to this police mode, so to speak. Right. I know that's, even though you're not a policeman anymore, it's so, become so ingrained in your psyche that, you know, and it's very difficult to switch on, switch off. Because it's a part of, you know, you can't be super observant and observe minute detail and then all of a sudden not be like that. So it tends to become a part of your...
Muscle memory.
Correct.
Sure.
I, as you know, I always take notes.
Yes, you do.
And prior to sitting down, and you don't know what I'm going to talk about, do you?
No, I don't.
Which is great.
Some would say it's irresponsible because I can't vet anything.
True, true, true. It's funny you use the word vet because that... pertains to the little... I took these notes and it says, and I'll read what I wrote, it said, do I really or did I really see that? Now, I needed to say that at the beginning of this entire season.
Okay.
Because the stories that I'm going to tell, when I was preparing my notes in terms of just little headlines for each episode,
yeah,
some of the stories are, to the listeners, going to appear and sound completely unbelievable.
Okay.
So,
I don't know. Last season, we did go some pretty weird places. You're saying it's going to be more
weirder,
so?
Weirder,
okay.
Totally much weirder.
Weird
but,
is always good.
But can I just say that I want to tell a little? It's an anecdote,
sure,
about something that I look back, and what I'd like to say to everyone out there is that we all have little things in our life that you've seen, and then you look back and you go, you know what? Did I really see that? Was I really there?
Mm.
So here's the story. It's a tiny, quick snippet.
Okay.
One night. Many, many years ago, it was a hot summer's night. I'm sitting in my car underneath the harbour bridge, and there's a wall to my right, which is about, let's say, 50 feet high.
Yeah.
It's an old convict-built stone wall.
What side of the bridge is this? The rock
this
side?
This is on the rock side.
Okay, so because when you sit under the bridge, I thought maybe you'd driven into the water and you were floating under the bridge.
No. I was sitting in a car just sort of chilling.
Great.
And
just when in time... Is this? Is this? This is during your forensics years, I assume.
Yeah, this is in the 1980s.
Yeah, give us a rough
say
year.
Perhaps 1985, 86.
Good year.
And I'm just sort of looking out the window of my vehicle, and I see a stick flying through the air. You with me?
Yeah.
And I thought, that's weird. And it came from way, 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 way up high, and it had gone over the wall, this stick.
And just to give people a picture, I think I know where you're talking about. The gulf between the road and the bridge is catastrophically
massive.
High. Like, it's really high. And the thing rocks is that, like, the rocks and Sydney in particular do altitude. You know what I mean? Melbourne's beautiful, but it's very flat. Mm. That part of Sydney is huge, huge, like, just the... So I think... I'm worried I know what you're going to say.
Well, I'll tell you what happened after the stick. Can you guess what happened? A dog came flying through the air. Are you with me? So picture this.
Yep.
There's a park that I couldn't see 50 feet up on the other side of the wall. And there's a beautiful park. And this guy's decided to throw a stick that the dog, of course, would chase and retrieve. Yep. So the stick goes over the wall and is sort of falling. And then all of a sudden... And I'm just sitting there thinking, this cannot be real. And this is why I'm telling this little story. The dog came over the wall and it's sort of realizing, I could see the dog realizing, you know, that it had a major problem in that it was going to hit the road in front of me. And obviously it was going to die. Now, all this wouldn't have gone through the dog's mind probably, but it went through my mind. And I sat there and the dog splattered in front of me. And then I looked up and the owner came. He didn't jump over with the dog, you'll be pleased to know, but he just leant on this wall and looked down to see his dog and to see and realise what he'd done. He'd thrown a stick over a 50-foot drop. The dog had sweetly, as it had done in the past, followed the stick to its death. And I tell that little story to you and the listeners because that is a story... That is an incident that I witnessed, but even to this very day, I question whether or not it really happened because it's so bizarre.
Okay, let's pick it apart a little bit. First of all, last season of Loose Units, Dad told a story where he tried to drive around a possum. Is there a possum on the road and tried to kind of like pass over it harmlessly to impress, I believe, a young girl who was working with you, a country officer.
Yep.
And you actually just destroyed this animal. Mm. The amount of listeners who, rightfully so, were disgusted with you.
They were very upset.
Really upset. So I just want to flag this as a moment in time where you've taken the first episode of our much-lauded second season and told the story about a dog flying through the air and exploding in front of you.
No, but...
No, Dad, what you don't seem to understand is that people will watch movies where men, women, and children die en masse, and they don't blink an eye. But the second you kill the dog, people walk out of the cinema. People hate dogs dying more than anything in the world. And dogs are basically perfect creatures. So what I'm saying is, have you done that? Have you made people turn off the show?
No. No, I just wanted to look. Because it's a surreal event.
Well, I mean, let's go back to the realism of it. What did you do afterwards? What, like, you're an off-duty officer, yeah?
Yeah.
You're sitting there. An animal has cruised through the air and plummeted to its death in front of your car.
Yep.
You can see the guy who technically did it. What do you do?
I got out of the car.
Oh, good. Good.
I made sure the dog had passed away.
Right.
In that it was pretty crook.
I think pretty crook is a generous...
I don't want to... Let's don't focus on the dog.
I think you focused on the dog, yeah, now we're all with you.
No, but the analogy being, of course, that in life you see things that... And then after the event and years later you go, you know what? And you start to sort of doubt...
You're not fucking Rudyard Kipling. This isn't Aesop's Fables. It's not. This isn't some metaphor. You just told a story. I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at the dead dog.
No, that was sad.
No, what I'm...
You know, I went on to... You know that I used to show dogs, don't you?
I know you did.
I don't tell many people.
I know.
Because that's moderately embarrassing.
Well, because we watched Best in Show and you kind of slunk into the couch. We'll deal with that in a future episode. What I want to ascertain is, like, how you deal with something this awful off-duty. So you've gotten out of the car, checked the dog. Do you remember talking to the owner?
No, because that would have involved shouting up to him because he was very high up and it would have taken him ages to get down. So
I would like to think at some point he would come down.
No, he probably did, but I didn't hang around. I found it all rather bizarre.
Is it a crime what he did?
Definitely not.
Why not? He killed the dog.
He loved his dog.
Yeah, but like he killed the dog.
Is it like
the dog? He didn't act well. Look, that's a legal point there.
But you're a policeman. It's your job.
Yeah, but one has to. Your heart goes out to him.
Sure. So you sat there. You put your fingers in the slush, and then you went, you know what? It's dead. I should probably go. I wouldn't want to hang around, because I mean, this is not. We're trying to set you up as the hero.
Speaking about sticking your finger in the slush, can I just say that we once found some bones on duty, and we had to take the bones to the Mater Hospital.
Yep.
We had to have a doctor come out with a stethoscope to pronounce life extinct. That's a true story.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Now, it was patently obvious that the bones were well and truly dead.
You couldn't give it a once over.
No, but legally speaking, our life had to be pronounced extinct.
So if the bones had assembled themselves necromancy style and traipsed out of the room, I mean, that would have been egg on your face.
Correct.
Sure.
But isn't that weird when you think about it, taking bones to have them? Now, the doctor clearly didn't take a stethoscope out and hold it to the femur, for example.
He didn't put two fingers on the wrist bone and listen for a few minutes to get the pulse rate.
But isn't that fascinating? There's a bit of, you know, bizarre trivia about what happens when you find bones.
Uh-huh. Well, if any listeners have found bones, please send us a message. We'd love to hear from you.
Now, I think it's time to start with a story.
I'd like to point out that this episode is now about 20 minutes long. We have well and truly started. And let me tell you something, Dad. I am worried about the reception with which we are going to be met for the dog story. So I would like to just quickly sidebar into something. We have been... I grew up with a lot of different dogs. We had like all kinds of different pets. We had a Bernese Mountain Dog. We had Staffies. My favorite Staffy was a Staffy called Yoda, so named because he had big pointy ears. Yoda was great, my favorite dog. You mentioned that you love dogs so much you were showing dogs. I think it's important because now that we've established the police side of you, just to quickly counteract that horrifying dog story with a good dog story. So,
okay, I've got a great dog story.
Yeah, great.
We had a lot of dogs. We had German Shepherds, Staffies, Belgian Shepherd.
Oh, right.
Which are a weird, bizarre kind of... They use them to retrieve cadavers in avalanches.
Hey, that's actually on point. That's on topic.
Okay, but the thing is, they're very immature for quite a few years.
Right.
But a dog that we did have that was quite a weird breed is called a Great Pyrenees. Now, these were bred to guard the nuns in the Pyrenees Mountains, up in the monasteries.
Who is after nuns?
Look, anyway, Paul, just on stay on point for just a sec.
Sure.
This is a story that this dog was so massive, and what inadvertently we'd done, we had a trampoline. Yeah. You recall the trampoline?
Oh, vividly.
And
yeah.
The dog would jump up onto the trampoline. It was huge. Mm. If anyone would like to Google Great Pyrenees, they'll see it's a massive dog. The trampoline in the middle would almost touch the ground. It was such a massive dog.
Yeah.
When this dog used to defecate, I literally had to bring in a bobcat to just shovel the extraordinary quantities of stuff.
Now, we happen to live upstairs with no bobcat access, so I know that's not true. Mm,
so I had to use a massive shovel. That okay. was a nightmare.
You downgraded just,
it cost so much money to feed that thing.
It did,
anyway,
yeah.
And it had this long white mane. Mm. It looked like something out of Neverending Story.
It looked like Falcor, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
So we once and once only took it to have it, groomed.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And we had this car, it was a Datsun 180B, and the dog was in the back. So I took it up. They spent about an hour grooming it.
Yep.
And it was a once, first and last time, because it was pretty expensive. And it was up in a suburb, up in the mountains, in the northern beaches.
Yeah.
And when I picked the dog up, I put the dog in the back of the car. Have you heard this story?
No.
Well, this is quite extraordinary.
Was I there? I must
no,
have
no,
been.
No, 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 okay. no. It was just me and the dog.
Sure.
And we're driving home, me and the dog, and I'm doing about 60 kilometres an hour. This is, again, this is such a true story, and it's so bizarre. Mm-hmm. And then I'm just cruising along at 60 kilometres an hour, and I became aware that there was something outside the car, and I looked down onto the road, and travelling at the same speed as me in the car was the dog. It had jumped out the window and it was rolling down the road at 60 kilometres an hour.
Rolling or running?
No, rolling.
Rolling?
You can't run at 60 kilometres an hour. It jumped out of the window, out of the back, and just started like a massive snowball. And I'm looking and I quickly pulled over, and then I was in complete shock. The dog just stood up and acted as though nothing had happened. And I opened the back door and the dog just hopped back in. And we went home. Incredible, isn't it?
What was the dog's name? You're going to need to remember the name.
Shit, I can't.
Or you're going to look like a monster.
No, I can't remember.
I know we had a... Was it Bronson? Was this Bronson?
Maybe.
I thought we had a Bernese Mountain dog called Bronson.
Not Bernese.
Pyrenees?
The Great Pyrenees.
Yeah, this is Bronson.
Okay, cool.
Bronson was a great dog.
Yeah. Anyway, we had to get rid of Bronson.
Why?
Because we didn't have enough room for Bronson.
Now, when you... Okay, so Bronson's gone, but yep. Bronson apparently is very resilient.
Is that a good story or...?
It's not a bad story.
Yeah.
It's a weird story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's starting to make you sound a bit negligent, but whatevs. Okay, well, I just thought that was an important sidebar, just to counteract the stressfulness of the other dog story.
Yeah. No, I love dogs.
I love dogs too. Yeah. In fact, if we weren't living in an apartment, we'd probably have one anyway.
They're beautiful.
So, okay... You had a story that you wanted to share before we wrap this episode up.
Yep, yep, yep. So look, this is we're really getting into the dark side, the underbelly of Sydney. So I'm going to start off with my first. I've given it a lot of thought as to what should be the lead story.
Yeah.
And then it's all downhill from there.
Like a rolling dog.
Mm, correct. So, all right, let me set the scene. King's Cross.
Yep.
There was one of the underworld figures, Abe Saffron.
Now Abe was featured in The Girl on the Balcony last season.
Really?
Yeah, remember there was the girl on the balcony who saw that stuff happen to her?
Oh, yeah, that was heavy.
Dad, yeah. But Abe, yeah. Now, was Abe the one who was...
He basically owned a lot of the nightclubs in King's Cross. So he owned a lot of nefarious clubs, strip clubs, all those sort of places.
Yeah.
And one of the places that he owned back in the 70s was called the Persian Room.
Okay.
Now, you haven't heard this story, Paul, so just come with me on the journey.
Sure.
Because it's pretty intense. So what used to happen is that a lot of these clubs employed bouncers. Now, we all know what bouncers are. I think they've changed a little bit in terms of perhaps their, they cut a bit more slack in this day and age. But back in the day,
yeah.
So if you were at a nightclub in the 70s and 80s in King's Cross and you were rowdy and you got carried away, you would be thrown out of the club. Now, some of these clubs had two ways of throwing you out. They'd either throw you out the front door, which was out onto Darlinghurst Road, which is sort of the middle of the cross where all the action is, or if you were particularly troublesome.
Yeah.
They would take you out the back. Now, at the back of the Persian room.
No witnesses.
Exactly. Mm. And on this particular occasion, they being two bouncers of, so they were massive, massive guys. But, I mean, they could have just thrown the guy out and that would have been the end of it. But they could have used their fists and pulverized him to within an inch of his life and that would have been it. But no, no, these particular bouncers who were particularly vicious, they decided to use a baseball bat on this guy's face.
Jesus
Christ. Okay? So in the first season, did I swear?
You swore a little bit. I think you generally kept the F-bombs down, but you definitely said shit.
Cool, cool. Well, they really, really went to work.
You can say what you can say what you want to say.
Well, they really fucked him over badly. Now, after they'd completely beaten the shit out of this particular guy, they then... I mean, we're talking near murder.
Sure.
He was just alive. Yeah. And then they got rid of the baseball bats. So that's two big guys using two bats on one guy's face. So it's hard to imagine, but I'm going to try and paint a bit of a picture because I guess you might be thinking, well, how did I get involved? At the time, I was working in the Central Fingerprint Bureau.
Now, fingerprints...
That's a part of forensics.
Sure. You know,
it's a whole section and it's an amazing section.
So this is a few years into forensics for you?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
And I'd been in charge of my area that particular week. Was the eastern suburbs. Mm. So I was in charge of pretty well every crime that went down in the eastern suburbs. And it was, believe you me, you know, back in the day, you know, I was attending up to, say, 15 jobs a day. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And I was coming back to the Central Fingerprint Bureau, which was in Liverpool Street, and I got a call over VKG saying, would I be able to attend St. Vincent's Hospital? And that's pretty well all the info that I had. So we paint the scene. I arrive at the hospital. I'm in plain clothes, and I'm wearing a dust jacket, so I look like a lab technician, you could say.
Yeah.
And I had my fingerprint gear with me. And I'm, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, what on earth is this going to entail? And I was met by a number of medical staff at St. Vincent's, and they took me up to intensive care.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene that I was confronted with was a lady with a couple of kids. And I now know that that particular lady was this particular guy. This is the guy that's been bashed.
Yeah.
This was his wife and these were his kids.
Oh,
and there were a couple of family members sort of standing around the bed and there were quite a few medical staff. And this guy, so now I'm going to describe what I saw. I saw a guy, his face looked like a pizza supreme. Like it was pretty... When I first saw this guy, I mean, I couldn't recognize him. I knew he was human, but he had all the things like nose, mouth, eyes, but they're all in the wrong place. That's what happens when you get bashed. And this was a really bad bashing. And he was on life support. Now, he had identification on him that told the police who he was, but he was so badly bashed that no one actually really knew who he was. Can you imagine that? That's fucked up. So the wife, the kids, and then I had to do something that I found quite depressing at the time. I had to fingerprint the guy.
Right.
So I asked that we sort of put the curtains around because I certainly didn't want the wife and the kids to see me fingerprinting this particular person that I could only assume was his father or their father.
Mm.
And there's a technique we use to get fingerprints off. Well, it's the same technique I used that day to get fingerprints off a living person is the same technique we use to get fingerprints off a cadaver or a deceased person. And it involves you get the fingerprint form and you fold it and you put it, you slide it through like this. It's sort of like a piece of copper that's cup shaped and it's called a morgue spoon. I mean, tell me that's not creepy.
That's pretty necromantic. Yeah.
So, and then you have to ink his fingers. So I had to kind of clean his fingers because he was still had a lot of blood on him. And he had bits of glass in his fingers because he'd fallen and been bashed out in a back lane of King's Cross where there was broken glass.
Yeah.
So he'd received a lot of... And he'd also had defensive wounds where he'd been putting his fingers and hands naturally. When you start to get bashed, you try and protect your face as the baseball blows are coming down. So he had a lot of broken fingers. And I'm confronted with this nightmare situation. It's heavy duty. So I had to try and get fingerprints as best I could, and I had to get 10 prints of all the, you know, thumbs, etc. So when I managed to get, so I'm inking this poor guy. I mean, it was not something for the public to see, and certainly not something for the family to see. And I'm just sort of, you know, I'm in my mid-20s. I've got a family. You're born, Anne's, you and Anne are at home, and Christine's at home, and, you know, it's, and there am I dealing in this pretty horrendous situation. And this is basically the story that I'm telling you is, A, this is just the tip of the iceberg for what you're all going to hear. The stories, some of them are going to be far worse than this, believe it or not. Mm. And this is what happens to people that are involved in forensics. This is, if you're working in forensics, this is what you do on a daily basis. It's fucked up. So what I then had to do, and this is the weird part of the story, we knew that the coroner, because he was going to die,
He was going to die.
He was on life support.
So he's totally non-communicative.
They kept him alive until we could officially identify him. Now, he was tattooed, and in my observations, I gleaned that he probably had a criminal record.
Right.
So my job then, when I had the fingerprints, I got out of there. I went back to the office, and I went back, and I did. I had to manually examine each fingerprint under a glass, and I had to then come up with all the different codings, and I then came up with, you know, a pattern.
Mm.
Then I went to the Grand Central Fingerprint Bureau, which has millions and millions and millions of fingerprints on file, and I was going through, and then I pulled it out. I got a match. And then with that match, we knew who he was.
Well, who was he?
He was a sort of a guy with a criminal record.
Do you remember what he did? What he did?
Nah, look, just minor shit. Sure. But it was good in a way that he actually was known, because there are other things you can do, which we'll go into in other stories, other ways of identifying people. And then I called through to the hospital, and they turned the life support off. That's it.
So if you've got proof of who he is, I assume what happens then? It's not your job as a forensics person to then follow the lead and find out who did it and persecute them, is it?
No, it's not.
But did you ever, like, what happened to the two bouncers?
Nothing.
What do you mean nothing?
No, it was all swept under.
They literally killed the guy.
Doesn't matter. Back in the 80s, you know, shit happens.
But they killed the guy.
Well, yeah, but that's, you know, these things happened.
But what, like, okay, isn't it bad for business for that to happen?
I don't think that story made the media. You've got to appreciate also that, you know, when I was in the police force, and I think we touched on this in season one, is that the police decide what is going to be for press. The police have a media room, and every morning, 7 days a week, the media meet in the room, and the police tell them what has happened in the preceding 24 hours.
Yeah, good friend
so
of ours.
So this is not mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not reported on.
So does that not make you angry, though, as a cop?
Of course it does. But, you know, King, there was the New South Wales Police Force, and then there was King's Cross, Darlinghurst.
Yeah.
So it's like another universe.
It's tricky with King's Cross because nowadays, because of the idiotic lockout laws, it's basically been drained of its nightlife, and it doesn't, you know, it's like it's unrecognisable. But back then, it truly was like an insane place.
Yeah.
Even in the 90s, I think it was still like that.
Well, you know, I was up in the Cross. I don't know whether I mentioned this to you about, did I tell you the little story a few months ago, or even perhaps 4 or 5 weeks ago, where in the main street of King's Cross, where there used to be Harley Davidsons with the Comancheros, Bandidos, the Hells Angels, now there are Vespas. True story.
Sure.
No, that's true. That's bizarre.
Instead of slinging meth, they're slinging artisanal Italian scarves around their perfectly
turned
necks.
It's a changed place.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But might I say, for people that live in the area, it's kind of nice.
Yeah, yeah. Gentrification is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Well, that was...
I apologise to the listeners that we ended on such a sort of a kind of a bit of a sad note. However, be warned that we're going into places far, far darker and murkier than that.
Yes, we are. And it's going to be an absolutely huge season. Typically speaking on the show, we will actually be answering listener questions, but as a first episode, we wanted to just focus on some of this stuff. And what we've done is kind of flash forward a little bit. Next episode, we're going to go back to the very beginning of forensics and kind of go through, you know, things like fingerprints and really get granular. But before we finish this inaugural episode of season two of Loose Units, I just wanted to thank a few people. I wanted to thank Derek Myers, who runs Castaway Studios, where we actually record the podcast. I wanted to thank my wife, Tegan Higginbotham, for essentially running things behind the scenes, running the social media channels and helping with production and doing all that stuff. And I wanted to thank Dad for being amazing. And don't forget to save the date. This is huge news. We are hosting a very special live Loose Units show on Friday the 31st of August at the Toff in Town in Melbourne. Ticket information will be available online next week. And if you haven't read Loose Units yet, head to Big W Online or penguin.com.au. But just a heads up, if you go to Big W Online and buy the book, it's much cheaper. So it's totally worth doing. Loose Units is proudly presented by Pillow Talk Productions. We will see you next week for another episode. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.